Make your fall fabulous at Mount Airy Lodge or Pocono Gardens. Do all the things you've wanted to do all summer, all day, all night. Winter, spring, summer, fall. Call 966-7210 for reservations at Pocono Gardens and beautiful Mount Airy Lodge.
Hello and welcome to Mountain Comics, proud member of the Fine Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and this is the show where I look back at the comic books I bought while on vacation in the Pocono Mountains of Pennsylvania in the 1970s and 1980s. And joining me in the cabin this month is fellow network all-star Ryan Daly. Hi, Ryan. Welcome back.
Thank you very much for having me.
Absolutely. So as everyone listening to the show knows at this point, we're on the last couple of episodes of Mountain Comics before I wrap things up. And if you have looked back on the earliest episodes, Shag was on the first episode and Ryan was on the second episode where we did a quote unquote live episode in the hotel room at, was that Boston, right? Boston Comic Con? That's had to be what it was.
I think it was our first one. It was the
Charlotte one. Oh, Charlotte. Okay. Yeah, it was in Charlotte. And we talked about Avengers 213. For the final two episodes of the show, I'm reversing that order in that Ryan is here for the penultimate episode. And then you can all figure out by the law of transitive properties who will be the guest on the final episode. And this was where, I mean, if you looked at the show notes, you know what we're here to talk about, which is Night Force number 4. So Ryan, I deeply appreciate you doing this because of course you've already covered this comic many years ago on your It's Midnight show. And so, you know, but I figured that was so many years ago. What the hell? If we can cover the Dr. Fate first issue special every 6 months on the network, you can come back and do Night Force after 7 years. But I do appreciate you willingness to go over this territory again with me.
I'm almost embarrassed to say how much I forget of a comic after a podcast about it. It's like once I vent all of my thoughts about it, I just like put that file in the trash can and at some point just delete it. Because I was like, oh, Night Force, what the heck happens in that issue? So, but no, I did have a lot of fun. I covered the entire series with my best friend, Paul Hicks, from the formerly of the Waiting for Doom podcast. And then we had a few guests later on. But it was an interesting adventure covering this story by Marv Wolfman and Gene Colan. And to revisit again all of these years later is...
Yeah, I really wanted to get to this one because I have, unlike some other Mountain Comics, I have a very specific memory of this book. This went on sale August 19th, 1982, so it would have been just 3 days after my 11th birthday. I remember buying this at the newsstand, and then there was a candle store that my mom and dad, I'm sure my dad would just went along. I don't think he cared. My mom liked to go to every time we were in the Poconos. Every year we went to the Poconos, she wanted to go to this candle store. And it was huge. It was like a tourist, not a tourist trap. That's more negative than means. But it was a place where tourists go because it was huge. It wasn't just like one room. It was like an old house that had been converted and it had 27 different rooms and you could just walk around forever. Anyway, they bought me this comic. And I remembered being and I had never read Night Force to this point. I think I had probably seen the free preview in New Teen Titans because I read that comic. But I had never seen any issues of Night Force at a newsstand before this. So this was the first one I saw. The cover by Gene Colan and I think Giordano is – I absolutely love it. No cover copy other than the title. And there's this woman – in a cave, this sort of abstractly drawn prison cell, and there's a guy who looks like he's got a snake coming out of his mouth. It's got this magenta background. I had never seen this comic before, and I was so entranced that I refused to go with them into the candle store. So they left me in the car. I'm 11 years old. It was the 80s, kind of like the hangover of the 70s. They let me just sit in the car and read this comic while I went inside to the candle store and shopped because I was like, I have to know what's happening in this comic right now. I can't wait. And I still have that memory. So many other things have come and gone. Like you just talked about, you know, comics you podcast about and you forget about it. I've had 43 years of accumulated memories that have gone by the wayside, but I still remember sitting in the back seat of my mom's Cadillac reading Night Force number 4 while baking in the hot Pennsylvania sun while they were candle shopping. That's how vital this comic was to me.
I'm shocked at the end of this issue when they get to the inferno burning down the building that you didn't rush into the candle store to try and save your parents.
I was a horror kid from a young age. I wasn't
Yeah,
like a little wuss like Chris Franklin has talked about. So I think I just handled this pretty well. But I just remember being so entranced by this cover, right?
it's a striking cover.
Oh my God. I mean, you don't see magenta is not a color you see on a lot of comics. It's just not
Oh,
a
no, of
color
course
that's
not.
used
Yeah.
very much. And the way it's composed by Gene Colan, it's absolutely fantastic. And again, I had never heard of this team. As far as I could remember, like I said, I must have seen them in New Teen Titans, but my 11-year-old brain, I was like, what is this? And it was, to save mankind, they became the Knife Force. I was like, oh my God, this is take my 60 cents, newsstand vendor. So here you go. So as everyone knows, I hate doing recaps. I find them incredibly boring. Part of the reason I'm like kind of getting out of doing comic related podcasts is because I just can't st doing recaps anymore. And I decided I'm not going to do a recap for this comic. I'm going to let Ryan do it for me, but not this Ryan, the Ryan of 2018. I went and pulled the audio from that episode of It's Midnight, which I am about to play, everybody. So sit back, relax, and for the next 19 and a half minutes, enjoy Ryan's summation of the plot of Night Force number 4, and we will join you all on the other side.
The Summoning, Chapter 4, is called Eyes. Same creative team on the art and script, but Todd Klein lettered the issue, and Adrian Roy is back on colors. Jack and Donovan are still treading water in the River Thames as the hydrofoil, or hovercraft rather, speeds toward them. On the boat, the imposters who pretended to be agents Carrie and Trevor shoot at the would-be heroes. Donovan has already been shot in the leg and is starting to lose consciousness. Jack grabs him and swims to the bottom of the river. He clings to an old tire to keep them below the surface and uses a rock to open Donovan's leg wound so the blood will rise and fool their attackers. Despite the fact that it's clearly nighttime and there is a full moon out, the foe, Carrie, and Trevor manage to see the blood in the water and assume that they did their job. The hovercraft races off, and a few seconds later, Jack and Donovan breach, taking in huge gulps of air. Later that same night, presumably because of the 5-hour difference between London and Washington, D.C., Detective Elliot Short visits the Potomac Psychiatric Hospital to ask Dr. Rabin about Vanessa. When he mentions the girl was kidnapped, Dr. Rabin accuses Baron Winters. Detective Short also asks her about Vanessa's psychotic episodes, and Rabin gives him the times of each fit. Later, back at the station, Short confirms that Vanessa's seizures correlate perfectly with the strange apparitions and attacks, with the worst, most violent occurring exactly during her kidnapping. Somewhere in England, Vanessa is alone in the dark. She's been beaten and starved by the men who kidnapped her, but they made one mistake in telling her that they needed her. That careless admission is enough for her because it reaffirms her belief that she is not crazy, she has not lost her mind, and that gives her hope. The foe, Carrie and Trevor, who are clearly KGB operatives, have brought Vanessa to the Russian embassy in England, which looks like a castle in the countryside. The ambassador is away at present, but some diplomat in the position of authority chastises them for bringing the girl there and risking exposure. The agents say they couldn't bring Vanessa to Moscow until they had confirmed her power levels, so they need one more test. They have brought in a specialist from Germany, Herr Zachary Zadok, who is just about the creepiest looking person you've ever seen. Even the man in charge of the embassy seems to tremble in Zadok's presence. Vanessa is still in the dark when suddenly a door opens. She can barely see the man who enters, and he refuses to answer her pleas for help. Then the man's eyes begin to glow, and the room is flooded with red light. We can see the man is Zadok, and suddenly the vicious snakes slither out from his mouth and eye sockets. Vanessa screams in horror. The snakes wrap around her, entwining her. Their fangs bite into her flesh and slash her clothing and skin. Vanessa is assaulted by all of her senses. From outside, however, we see that Zadok has just approached Vanessa's cell with the others. He goes inside and lifts up her semi-conscious form, telling the others that she knew he was coming. In London, Donovan Kane's gunshot wound is treated and he is released from the hospital. He still wants to go after the guys who killed his wife. Donovan and Jack consult the book they picked up last issue, a book supposedly printed in the 1920s, despite having a picture of Vanessa on its frontispiece and a profile of a Russian psychic from the 1960s. Back at the hotel, Donovan reads the book and learns about Russia's advanced study into parapsychic phenomena. Jack gets Donovan to open up and talk about how he met his wife. Then Jack shares the details about how he and his wife Annie eventually split up. During this bonding activity, Jack stares out the window and sees the flag of the Russian embassy. He feels like an idiot for not guessing that the enemy would take Vanessa not to the main mission in London, but to their private estate out of town. Back in Georgetown, Detective Short goes to interrogate Baron Winters about Vanessa's kidnapping. He thinks she's being taken to the Soviet Union and notes that Baron Winters is from there, isn't he? The Baron says he left before the revolution, which would not seem possible based on how old the Baron appears to look. Detective Short gets frustrated by the lack of answers coming from Baron Winters and opens the door to the grotto. But when he looks out, he doesn't see the Baron's garden, but rather a scene from colonial America. Winters slams the door shut and asks the detective to stay inside. Not believing his own senses, Detective Short opens the door again, only to see the garden exactly as it should have been. At the embassy, Herr Zadok has Vanessa drugged and strapped to a chair with electrodes. The others watch him flip a switch and electricity jolts through Vanessa. She wakes up staring into Zadok's eyes, eyes that send her into the far reaches of a dream. Out of darkness comes the moon, and a face begins to form on the moon. At first, the face is hideous, like Zadok's. Then she sees the eyes change, becoming more reptilian, and finally, the face on the moon is that of a snake. On the road, Jack and Donovan drive toward the Russian embassy. Donovan explains the nature of Vanessa's power again for Jack and the reader. Donovan's students used their ritual to project their vision of evil into Vanessa's mind. Her power was to give that vision a physical, tangible form through her psychic power. If the Russians can harness her power, she could potentially destroy the world. The thought is terrifying to Jack, who just might regret sleeping with her at this point. In the embassy, Zadok and the Russians watch raw psychic energy flow like fire off of Vanessa. The boss man tries to get Zadok to end the experiment by tranquilizing the girl, but Zadok is completely awestruck by her power levels. That fascination is his undoing. The psychic energy lashes out as a wave of fire that engulfs the room and incinerates Herr Zadok. The agents sedate Vanessa and carry her out to the car as the embassy building burns to the ground. The diplomat, Gargarin, has no idea how he will explain this, but the others don't stick around to find out. After the sun has risen, Donovan and Jack pull up to the charred remains of the embassy. Donovan pieces together what happened and knows that if Vanessa is still alive, they've taken her to the Soviet Union. And that is where he and Jack must go next. To be continued in Night Force Issue 5.
And we're back. So, Ryan, you said you reread this comic after many, many years. How did it read to you now in 2025 as opposed to how you enjoyed it then?
First of all, I'm sorry to the listeners because I think I aged in real time again.
We've all aged more than the number of years since then.
I was so detailed and descriptive in my synopses. I think that's why I burned out on Nightcast and so many of these shows. I just spent so much time recapping them. It's a crazy comic, and I think it took me a little while to discover it with Paul as we were going through it, but I think I came to realize what Marv Wolfman was doing was really writing a novel that for some reason he decided to do as a comic instead of prose. And to be completely honest with you, despite the fact that Gene Colan is my favorite comic book artist, I think the story should have been a novel. I think it would have translated better that way. I think a lot of the story of like the themes going on in here were really like big in the 80s. Like there's a Cold War type of subgenre of horror that has to do a lot with just paranoia and apocalyptic visions of the future and mental powers and stuff. Stephen King did this a lot, like with Firestarter and some of his other work around this time, like with The Stand. There's a book that I read last year called Carry and Comfort by Dan Simmons from the 70s. I think maybe it was the 80s. But it's very similar to this because it involves these kind of immortal psychics who kind of like play chess on a global stage, like with like people with like nuclear weapons and everything like that. And the horror is just like, if you're reading that book, you're like, oh, I understand why in the X-Men universe, the government would want to regulate these mutants because it's kind of terrifying what they can do the way that's depicted. So a lot of these same themes are in this whole Night Force comic and what Vanessa is going through with these psychic images, but also the fact that the protagonists are just a psychologist and a beat reporter. And for some reason, this enigmatic Baron Winters decides these are the two people he's going to send on this clandestine James Bondian adventure into Russia to save this poor woman. It's a crazy story, and there are weird elements in it, and there are things that are just kind of like, okay, Marv, I think you could have thought about that a little bit more. But overall, it's a fun story. When you take the entire thing, which went into the middle of issue 8, so if you count the preview in New Teen Titans, the story, the summoning, was really like 8 issues long, and it would have been a great novel. As a comic book, it's okay.
Okay, your conception of
Sorry,
it,
that's big picture, because that was just me thinking about the entire series, but
right. I will tell you, reading it over again. Well, okay, let me go back. What I like to do for these Mountain Comics is when I knew that it was a book that I was discovering for the first time, when I was in the Poconos, I go to Mike's Amazing World and look to see, oh, did I get the? Can I remember? Did I get the next one? Right? Did I continue to buy it when I got home? And I looked at the covers and I did. I remember getting Night Force number 5. So obviously I liked this enough to get the next one. The other thing I can remember is Night Force did not show up on my 7-Eleven spinner racks very much. So I think I found number 5 and either I didn't like number 5 and I didn't continue, or more likely I didn't find it again. And by the time Mountains rolled around in 1983, Night Force was canceled. It was canceled as of number 14. So the book wasn't even around for me to keep buying. I remembered really liking it. Obviously, like I said, I was so enraptured. I was reading in the back of my parents' car. Reading it again here, I really enjoyed it. I never thought of it as a novel. I actually, watch reading it, I thought of it as this would make a great adventure TV show. This would make a really great hour-long drama. And it's got that kind of feeling to it of like something that a network would have tried, and they would run it like Friday nights at 10 and just see if anybody was watching. It was one of the, I feel like it would be one of those shows that would run for half a season and get canceled. And then 10 years later, people would go, man, do you remember that show Night Force? That was so cool. What a weird show. Like it was one of the kind of, that kind of thing. And the, and so you're, but your mentioning of it as a novel is interesting because, DC and Marvel did do that. They did novels of some of their comic books, and most of it were like sort of merchandising tie-ins. They did one for Challenges of the Unknown for some reason, but there's like a Black Hawk one, and like I could see this, now that you've said it, I could see this as a prose novel with like a painted Gene Colan cover. Right, I could absolutely picture that, and it actually probably would have worked really interestingly. And one of the other things that I think gives it kind of an additional context is, and I generally don't talk about the ads in the book because I don't know, it just don't really doesn't concern me too much. But this issue has that classic DC ad. DC is on the move, right? And it's the ad with Camelot 3000, Arion, Lord of Atlantis, Supergirl, and again Blackhawk. Now, no offense to Blackhawk, which is the Mark Evanier, Dan Spiegel run, which I have on older podcasts have praised, to the high heavens. And no offense to friend of the network, Paul Kupperberg's run on Supergirl. But I really like, I feel like Night Force belongs in this ad, right? Because they're trying different things. I mean, no, again, no offense to Blackhawk and Supergirl, but it's like, okay, we've done that a bunch of times. I think this ad would have been more effective if it was like, oh, here is a bunch of new concepts that we're trying. Camelot 3000, Arion, Lord of Atlantis. By the way, it's also Paul Kupperberg, so he's on this ad twice for Pete's sakes. But like, I think Night Force almost would have had like additional context if it had been sold this way of like, we're trying lots of new things and here's one of the things. And yeah, I don't, reading it over, I still liked it a lot. I was probably thinking, geez, what did I don't know. At 11, I might have been like, well, I don't even know what's going on here. You know what I mean? Like, I'm so in the middle of all of it. I will say I loved Herr Zadok, right? The weird looking guy. And what he reminds me from is if you've anyone's ever seen a William Castle movie, which was the William Castle was, the character that John Goodman sort of plays in Matinee, sort of based on him, old time Hollywood producer, kind of like basically like a B-level Hitchcock. All of his movies have at least one, they're all horror movies for the most part. All of his movies have one person in them with weird makeup that nobody mentions. People that just, you know, like everyone's kind of normal looking. And then there's one person who looks bizarre and no one comments on it. That's what this felt like to me, was her Zadok just shows up and everyone's just like, okay. And you're like, what? This guy looks like a corpse. What is going on here? But I really enjoyed this. The color work by Adrian Roy, all the color holds with the fantasy, the dream sequences with the snake coming out. All that was really, really well done. And I love Gene Colan. So I thoroughly enjoyed this. I could see why kids, you know, probably were like, what? What is this? You know what I mean? Like
it's an adult story. It's a mature story. Yeah. It's a long form mystery. So the fact that it was done as a serialized comic in this way, again, I think you're right. I think as a TV show, as a serial TV show, it would have been fairly well done.
Yeah.
Yeah, it just kills me because I do love Gene Colan's art, obviously. And the pages that you mentioned when Herr Zadok, this crazy, like, ex-Nazi scientist, you have to imagine, with this, like, scarred face that's bizarre. I don't know if listeners can picture this. Like, for some, his face kind of reminds me of, if you've seen the movie Hannibal, the sequel to The Silence of the Lambs, that I think Ridley Scott directed Hannibal.
Yes, he did.
Gary Oldman plays the character, one of Hannibal's early victims who survived.
Oh my, he does look like that. You're right. Yeah.
Redone. Like, there's just something like it's like half melted and half just like scarred up. Like, it's just weird. And then, these images of her with the colors and the astonishing and the snake coming out of his head and the way she's attacking. It's frightening. And I mean, Gene Colan, like, I don't like his art because because of his perfect anatomy, because of his amazing line work and technique and, like, the way he captures everything. It's so evocative, I guess. Just, like, his art makes me feel more than other artists do. Mm. And it just puts me in a kind of atmosphere of mind. And I think he is really suited for horror and mystery. That's why he had such a long famous run on Tomb of Dracula with Marv Wolfman.
Yep.
So I think in a book like this, I mean, okay, maybe John Byrne would have made it look really good, but why would you want to use John Byrne on a story like this? That's not like what he excels at.
Yeah.
But I think Gene Colan elevates this for a story where people are just in plain clothes driving around the countryside and talking in mental hospitals. There's not a whole lot that can really like bring that art and make it exciting, except for Gene Colan's style, because he makes characters walk a little bit weird. Like Detective Short seems a little bit gangly when he's walking through the mental hospital. And there's this great panel. It's on page 4. It's the center panel where he's walking with the doctor. They both got their back to us. They're walking down this hallway talking about Vanessa kidnapping. There's a woman, a patient on the far right, like kind of like holding her hands or clapping her hands. And she's just kind of looking up into the, like with its kind of like dazed, almost a smiley face, like just entranced by something. And it's,
are you there, God? It's me, Margaret.
Something about that. So yeah, just things about that. Like, and you're right. Like, the going back, because the cover, I do think this is the best cover of the series by a wide margin. Mm-hmm. Not just because of the striking magenta colors, but the image. Like, I think I mentioned this to Paul Hicks when we were discussing it on Midnight. But you could take the title Night Force off of this, and I could see this cover on a cover to House of Mystery or Midnight, The Witching Hour.
Oh, totally.
One of the DC's other horror anthologies. This just looks like an image of something that Bernie Wrightson could have drawn, or Neil Adams back in, you know, 69 or 70.
Oh, totally. Totally. It's a grabber of an image. And I said, I'm sure that's why the 11-year-old me, after I got the comics I wanted the most, had more money to spend, and I was like, ooh, let me try this, because that is just, I've always been a fan of Gene Colan. His anatomy, his people have a weird, I mean, this isn't anything that has not already been said on this network, on other shows, but Gene Colan's anatomy, it's like the people don't quite have like bones in their bodies, of, like they seem kind of mushy, sort of, or, and their clothes, everyone's clothes are rumpled. He's really great at drawing clothes, but everyone just and everyone's poses are just, you know, their legs contort in strange ways, and it's a very peculiar style. It doesn't. There's no one else that looks like this, right? I can't think of another artist that ever drew anything that looks like Gene Colan. The page where the full page shot of Vanessa, where she's getting grabbed by these, and it's in the color hold of these snakes. Mm-hmm. Like the perspective is wild. Like her feet are kind of like near the front of the camera, and she's pulling away. It's the kind of I was taught this back in art school, that it was like only after you master anatomy in terms of drawing it can you then abstract it. You have to have the basics first. You can't just draw the abstract, because then it's nothing. And that's, you know, I feel like that's Colan knows the anatomy backwards and forwards, and he then has the power to stretch it and pull it and drag it in ways that are just completely bizarre, but yet work.
And that's Chris Franklin and I talked about that on Nightcast a long time ago, because that sort of explains my love for Norm Breyfogle too, because his art, especially as it went along, his art got kind of wonky, and it's like, all right, this doesn't look like normal anatomy, but it still had that evocative sense. And it was like, I was like, okay, he knows how to draw the correct way, and now he's taking his own little expressive spin on it. Whereas I felt like other more successful artists of that, who were contemporaries of his, that went on to found their own companies, I never convinced they actually did know how to draw the correct anatomy. They were always a little bit off.
Mm-hmm.
But
And I agree with you. It's funny. I never really thought of it before, but like this notion of that it's got like a political subtext mixed in with the horror. And that does fit in with a lot of stuff that was going on at the time in horror movies and stuff, was this blending of, you know, there's some kind of a political thing to it, or like a real world scenario, but yet there's this horror element. I mean, there's a movie called The Ninth Configuration, which is a sidequel to The Exorcist, if you can believe it. And it follows the astronaut in The Exorcist, who Reagan says, "You're going to die up there." It follows him into another story. And it's written by William Peter Blatty, who wrote The Exorcist. So it's a sidequel to The Exorcist. It's very bizarre, but it's got a lot of political stuff in it. Meanwhile, it's got all the supernatural horror. So this feels like that to me. I think that's a really great way of sort of tagging it with what was sort of going on at the time. And
I think part of that was sort of like, I mean, the cultural zeitgeist of like thinking of like, because our enemy was the Russians essentially at the time, or this Cold War enemy, they looked like us. It wasn't an exotic looking foreigner or something. So I think that played into the, a movie that you've seen a lot, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, kind of that same thing of the enemy that walks among us. And I think that plays into like the, why the, so much of the supernatural element has to do with mental powers and telepathy and telekinesis. Again, Stephen King did this with the book The Dead Zone, which also had a very political link to it as well. And maybe part of this was also not just with the Cold War, but this was after kind of like the whole acid LSD explosion and everything, just sort of mind altering mind consciousness, and maybe an increased awareness on that kind of blended with the fear and the paranoia, and made like this kind of, you know, this was sort of like a sub thing within horror of this kind of telepaths and the end of the world.
Absolutely. Now, can you remember, a lot of these you haven't read in many years. Did they ever fully acknowledge that Night Force is in the DCU during this original run? I know they did eventually, but like in these 14 issues, did they ever explicitly bring it, like, to, you know, let you know this is the DC universe?
I don't think so.
Okay.
And again, somebody might be able to remember better and correct me. I don't think within the book they ever acknowledged anything that sets this in the DC universe.
Okay.
Baron Winters appears outside of this book, like in Swamp Thing famously.
Yeah.
But I'm sure he's the only character from this book that does appear elsewhere. Him and his pet leopard.
Right. And they did another series. Like they did another Night Force miniseries and stuff like that.
But I think that was, I think Marv Wolfman was specifically intending that, like this is separate, which interesting because he was also doing, Crisis at the time. But I think, yeah, he wanted this to be separate in its own little pocket universe, its own separate entity. And again, I was just like, Mark, why didn't you just sit down at the computer and just write this full out prose? Because throughout the comic, there's dense captions and like panels that are just like a paragraph of text.
The page with Vanessa getting attacked by the snakes is almost like this is like just let the art just do this, right? We don't need 17 captions. I always said I know that we talked about this on some other episode at some point in all the, all the 9 years we've been doing the network, but like when DC canceled all their horror books, which was not too long after this, I wish they had done like an anth a dollar and anth well, the dollar comics were long since gone at this point, but like an anthology comic of all their horror characters in one book. Like, right, none of these characters can quite support their own title, but like do the House of Mystery as an 80 pager and it's got Nightforce and the Phantom Stranger and Black Orchid, and you know what I mean? Like, that
Oh
would have been
man,
really fun, and none of Swamp Thing was obviously already a hit, but like all the other ones, like, just they don't quite. They can't quite sell a book, but we can give them 14 pages. That'll do it, right? I think that would have been really cool. But
That was essentially what I was trying to do with Midnight, the podcasting hour, and
there you
the
go.
weight of it crushed me.
Yeah, maybe there's a reason not to do it. But anyway, I enjoyed this. It was a lot of fun. And it's a great memory of all the great memories I have of the Mountain Comics. It's a great memory of sitting in that car and being that excited, right? It's just that's just, like I was so enraptured by that. I was like, I can't wait. I can't wait for the 45 minutes of my parents wandering around looking at candles for me to drive home and read this. I got to read this right now. And it's just a great memory. And it was always something that I wanted to get to on the show before we wrapped up. So, Ryan, thank you so much for coming back and doing this with me and covering with me again. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. This was fun to revisit. I didn't imagine I would ever come back to this series. But it was a lot of fun. And if listeners want to hear more about it, go check out old episodes of Midnight the Podcasting Hour. Me and Paul talked about the whole series. I think we brought in Dr. Ange and Martin Gray towards the end of our run. Yeah, it was fun times.
Yeah, show's still up. So, why don't you tell people what you're working on the network right now?
Oh, you can find me on Cheerscast, where I have started covering season 9, which is a whole bunch of fun. Loving this. Chris Franklin and I have started doing Batman Nightcast again. Me, Paul Kinn, and Max Romero, every couple of months, are doing The Sandman Slept Here, where we're covering Sandman Mystery Theater, the Vertigo comic. That's part of the Justice Society Presents feed. My brother and I, from time to time, do a Fire and Water Records episode. And I keep lingering over Shag's head that I'm going to bring back, Give Me Those Star Wars, just because I feel threatened by him.
I am altering the deal. Pray I don't alter it any further. I think we can support two Star Wars shows on the network. I don't, what the hell? We got like nine Batman shows. What's wrong with two Star Wars shows? It's a big universe. Well, again, thank you so much, Ryan. Thank you all for listening. Of course, you can find me on Blue Sky under Rob Kelly Creative. And if you want to support the Fire & Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FWPodcast, and there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is a name checked on a show of your choice. So as we're wrapping up here, I got to thank Neil Whitney and Chuck Dill, who have specifically asked to be mentioned on Mountain Comics. I really appreciate it, the support on the show. So, and of course, you can find all the back episodes on the website, FireAndWaterPodcast.com. So that is going to do it. Ryan, where are you on Yoohoo? Where are you on that? Do you have an opinion on that?
On Yoohoo?
Yeah.
I don't. I'm
Have you ever
sure.
had it?
I'm sure I have. I just.
Okay. So
If it's a sponsor, I love it.
okay,
Absolutely. I
fair enough.
can't get enough of it.
I should have reached out to them. Who else is going to call them for that, right? Nobody's calling them for that. But anyway, yeah, Ryan and I are going to crack a few Yoo-hoos and set out on the deck of the cabin and watch the sun go down. And so again, thank you all for listening. And as I mentioned at the top of the show, next month will be the final episode of Mountain Comics, where my guest will be the irredeemable Shag. Stay tuned for that, everybody. It's going to be very exciting. We will see you later. Bye.
Have a summer of fun in the Poconos. At your host with the most in the Poconos. Beautiful Mount Airy Lodge.
every kind of summer fun at Mount Airy Lodge or Pocono Gardens. Beautiful rooms, fabulous food, headline entertainment. Winter, spring, summer, fall. Call 966-7210 for reservations at Pocono Gardens and...
Beautiful.